Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Academic Life Channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Dana Malone. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Clara Renzetti, Professor and Chair of Sociology and the Judy Conway Patton Endowed Chair for Studies of Violence Against Women at the University of Kentucky. And we'll be talking about her experiences mentoring in the academy. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dana. I'm happy to be here.
We're excited to have you on today. Claire, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'll go back to the beginning. I was born and raised in Wilmington, Delaware, which is the second smallest state in the Union. But also, you may have heard of Delaware because it's the home state of President Joe Biden. And I also attended school at his alma mater. My alma mater is the University of Delaware. I went there for all of my degrees, undergrad and grad, and I really loved it. I got my PhD in 1982 in sociology with a specialty in gender and criminology, and took my first job at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, where I worked for 26 years, 10 of those as department chair. I left there and went to the University of Dayton. I was only there for about 5 years when I was recruited to the University of Kentucky, to the sociology department and to the Center for Research on Violence Against Women as an endowed chair. I thought my department chairing days were over, but I was there for a couple of years and I was asked if I would chair the sociology department. And I said yes. I didn't say yes quickly. I don't want to make it sound like I was all that excited about doing chairing again. But I had been in the department for 2 years and realized what a good group of people it is and how fortunate I was to be there. And they needed a full professor to chair. And so I agreed to do it. And that was 8 years ago. And I just signed up for another 2 years. So 2 years from now, I will I'll be able to say that I spent 20 years of my career as a department chair. And some people question my sanity when I say that, but the fact is I've been really fortunate to have chaired two departments that, like I like to say, chair themselves, because I have colleagues who really pitch in and really do their share, who are kind to one another and respect one another, which makes the chair's job really pretty easy. And I've had that both at St. Joe's and at University of Kentucky. So I've really been doubly fortunate in that regard. And so that's where I am right now.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. And I always like to let listeners know when I'm talking to someone that I know personally. And so I do know Claire. She's at the University of Kentucky. And I think our listeners know by now that I got my doctorate at the University of Kentucky. And so Claire was actually the outside examiner for my dissertation defense, and her reputation preceded her. My chair was very, persistent that, you know, we need to have Claire Renzetti on your committee. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was not familiar with Claire before, but she, you know, my chair of my committee spoke very highly of her and just thought she would be a great fit. And I was like, okay. And Claire graciously, I think we had coffee. That time was kind of a brain fog. I think my son was like a newborn-ish baby at the time, and everything was just a fog. I was like, oh, okay. But I do remember one of my fond stories and memories of Claire when I realized, oh, okay, this is legit. I'm sitting in my defense, and we're having a lovely conversation. And at one point, one of the main scholars' work who I had used and I really dug into, like, she had a book and I found her dissertation, and I just was one of the two studies that I really looked at in depth as a model for how I was going to do my own study. And so that I knew the scholars work very well. And Claire was like, oh, Katie. I was like, oh, she's on a first name basis. And she's like, oh, she was a student of mine. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, I laugh because, you know, I'm a graduate student and it just, you're, it just was like, wow. Okay. Kind of like a little behind the curtain scene of, I was like, okay, this is, you know, she's legit. She knows people really. Not only does she know them, she like mentored this person. And this was a student of hers. And so you kind of realize also, I think, how small the world is. But then that was my moment when I was like, okay, Claire Renzetti, yes, she's a good person to have in the room today. And I was very fortunate and glad that we got connected and stayed connected. And I will say that Claire really helped mentor me through some my first go around with academic publishing. And we're going to talk a bit about that as well today. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to share a little personal story and let our listeners know that we are talking to a personal contact of mine and a friend that I and a colleague and that I greatly respect. And I'm so glad she's here.
And I'm glad that we got to meet, Dana, because it's really been my pleasure. I really have enjoyed reading your work. It's excellent work. And I consider myself lucky to have gotten to know you. So there you have it.
Yes. So a little, we're just kind of modeling mentoring right here on the show, which is why I wanted Claire on because I know she's done such wonderful mentorship in her career. So that leads into what has inspired you? What inspired you to begin mentoring other scholars?
Well, I don't think this comes as a surprise to anyone who does mentor. It was that I was mentored and it made a huge difference in my life and in my career. I had a professor as an undergraduate, Dr. Frank Scarpitti. He taught me my first criminology class. And in fact, it was because of him and that intro to criminology that I changed my major and decided to pursue that topic. I didn't think of graduate school at the time, but he just made it so interesting that I wanted to do that. I knew that it was for me. So I made another change of my major. It was my second change of major. But this one took, right? Third time's the charm. And he was just a lovely person. He didn't assume a dominant mentoring role. He was truly a guide and offered lots of advice. And when I got to graduate school, he continued that. He was not just a professor, but also the department chair. And I have to say that I observed him. He was department chair for a long time. And I observed him as a department chair in his interactions with faculty and students. I saw how he resolved problems. I saw how he managed a department that had a lot of, it was a very prominent criminology program. And in that type of program, there are a lot of egos. And he was really good with managing people with big egos, but who sometimes conflicted with one another, and he handled it really well. I mean, he never focused on the person. He always focused on the problem. And I just watched him do all that. And when I became a department chair, he was really my model for how to chair a department. And currently I facilitate a program for department chairs at the University of Kentucky called the Chairs Academy. And one of the topics I've been assigned to address in that workshop, actually it's a series of workshops that goes over two semesters, but my topic that I talk about is dealing with difficult people, which I think is really kind of funny. I don't know what qualifies me to do that in particular. But one of the things I always tell people is, you know, we all have folks who we look up to and who we want to model. And I always mention Frank. I always say when I'm in a bind as a chair, I always think, WWFD, what would Frank do? Because he handled these things so well. Sadly, he died 2 years ago, but I got the opportunity to see him several weeks before he died. I went to visit him and we sat pretty much knee to knee holding hands, and I got to thank him. And I got to tell him what a tremendous impact his mentoring had had on me. And he acted almost surprised. And I said, oh, you just don't know. There's so many things that I do now that go back to you and how you handled things. So a mentor can have a tremendous influence on you and in a bunch of different ways. And you don't always have just one mentor, but I would say he really stood out to me. And when you have someone like that, that you know you're benefiting from their guidance, you want to extend that to someone else if you can. And so that has really inspired me to, you know, provide guidance, answer questions, lend a hand, whatever I can do for colleagues, which is really what mentoring is. It takes a lot of different forms.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that story. And it's such I think there's a couple points I just want to highlight there. One, I'm so glad that you got to tell him what he meant to you, and especially before he passed, what a I'm sure a special moment for you, and that he was surprised by that. I think a lot of times we don't realize what our impact can be on others, or things that we say, or just even how we do our work and how people are watching, our students are watching, and the impact that has. So I'm so glad you got to share that with him, and just the lifelong nature of that mentor relationship. I have a longtime mentor from my undergrad years, and it's how I got into student affairs work. And he's still someone I text and still someone I am in contact with. And I'm sure that I will be for the rest of my life. And you, when you think about that over a lifetime, what a beautiful thing. And so I enjoyed hearing that story, and thank you for sharing that. At this point in your career, Claire, you've had the opportunity to mentor people all along the academic career trajectory, from graduate students to new faculty to seasoned academics. Kind of as a way into this conversation, I was hoping you could talk a bit more about your experiences mentoring people along that continuum.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I said, there's so many different types of mentoring and so many different ways we mentor. I think people tend to think of it as a formal relationship lots of times, that you're matched with a person. And certainly I've participated in those kinds of mentoring programs. I'll be honest with you, they are my least favorite. I'm happy to volunteer to do things, but I tend to find that the mentoring relationship needs to be somewhat organic. And this, some of these mentoring programs, you end up with, for lack of a better metaphor, a forced marriage. And they don't always work out real well because, and I say this to people who get frustrated as mentors. I always say, well, you know, mentees are part of the mentoring relationship. It's not all on you. And sometimes that relationship just doesn't take, particularly if you've been matched by someone else, you know, because it's not just a matter of sharing the same, say, research interest, you know, it's sort of, you know, being able to feel comfortable with an individual, being able to sit down and talk with them, whether in person or on Zoom or by phone, email conversations. You have to feel, both people have to feel comfortable with one another. And sometimes that just doesn't happen unless the relationship has developed organically. So I've found that some of my most successful or most, I don't want to say successful, some of my most rewarding experiences, whether it's mentoring undergraduates or graduate students or early career faculty or whatever, has been just when, you know, like in your case, Dana, where we just kind of met by happenstance in a way, or somebody said, you know, you should meet this person. Mm-hmm. And, or this, I have a student who has a question. I think this is up your alley. And you start talking and you just kind of click, you know, and I like to tell people who seek me out for advice or book suggestion or whatever, you know, contact me anytime, email me if you, you know, and we'll set up a time to talk, but it doesn't have to be a one-off kind of thing. So I feel like that sort of organic growth of the relationship, but also the willingness of the mentor to remain open to contact is really important. And it's really, you know, it's really rewarding to develop relationships with all different types of people at all different stages of their life and their career, you know, hear different stories and find out different interests. And, you know, it just seems to me to be so much better than just signing up and saying, I'm willing to mentor, or I need a mentor and match me. And then just having some sort of categories, matching categories. It just doesn't always work out that way. And then the mentor feels like a failure. And the mentee feels like, you know, gosh, this was a waste of my time. I didn't get anything out of this. It's just not very good, you know? and we don't, we have limited resources. And one of our most limited is time, right? So yeah, nobody wants to waste anybody else's time.
Thank you. So thinking also about the, you know, across that career trajectory, have you noticed or observed different needs in mentees or, you know, and mentors across that continuum? Mm-hmm. What needs, how they change? What have mm-hmm. you noticed in those relationships?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dana. You know, obviously undergraduate students have different concerns than graduate students or early career faculty. So, you know, an undergraduate student may want to talk to you about internship opportunities or why did you choose this field? You know, how did you get into this? And if I don't want to be a professor, what other things can I do? And, you know, and especially I want to go to graduate school. How do I do this? And what's it like? And what programs are good programs? And of course, one of the things that a mentor can do in that situation is say, I know so-and-so at this university. Let me introduce you guys over email. And you can start asking them questions about their program and that sort of thing. And sort of just giving them a foot in the door or introducing them to someone, an alum maybe, who is working in a field that is similar to the field they want to go into after graduation. And that can be very important. You know, graduate students are typically seeking out advice, career advice, but in a different sense, in a different level. So they might be wanting to make a decision between if they want to be a professor, they may want to make a decision between a Research One institution or a smaller teaching, liberal arts teaching institution, or they need advice about publishing because that can be a really scary thing to think about when you're in graduate school. And I've told you, I spend tons of time doing workshops on publishing for graduate students to take some of the mystery out of the process and make it a little less daunting. And of course, they're seeking mentoring with regard to research. They may want to try a method that they haven't, you know, used before. And you, as the mentor, you've used this method repeatedly and you can help. You can provide guidance in terms of articles and books to read, but you can also, again, help them get in their foot in the door with regard to if they're going to do field research, a site, if you know people that can help them in terms of gaining entree to a field research site. And then faculty, of course, early career faculty are concerned with tenure. And again, publication is a big part of that. But another thing that early career faculty are concerned about is service, the burden of institutional service, you know, and what counts, what's important, what service should I do? And I think what happens lots of time with early career faculty is that they feel like they have to say yes to everything they're asked to do. And then their time is getting eaten up by service work and they're not able to get their research and writing done. And they've got they've still got to teach their classes and they want to be good teachers because that's really important to them. And so I get asked lots of times for guidance with regard to what service should I do, you know, and how much and what counts and that sort of thing. You know, along the faculty rank trajectory, you know, you may have somebody who is a tenured full professor and has always done journal publications, and now they want to write a book, and they don't know how to go about getting a publisher or writing a book proposal or that sort of thing. Or you may have someone who has never applied for a grant before, has never applied for a grant from a particular agency, and they seek you out to ask you questions about that. And it's really just a collegial relationship. You know, you're just sharing advice and sharing information that may be helpful, and always putting people in touch with other people. I think one of the neatest things about mentoring and being mentored is that it creates even more new relationships. So you end up developing a network and connecting people and getting to know new people as a result of mentoring and being mentored. And that's really exciting. And it's also really fun. I mean, it's beneficial career-wise, but it's beneficial personally too. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, and I think of it too, in terms of just, you know, to linger a minute on that last point. You know, I think it happens professionally, or there's similar dynamics professionally and personally with our relationships of people, like, and you spoke to this, like the organic nature, it's who you click with and your mm-hmm. ways of being kind of being similar, or, you know, your research interests or whatever that is, but you click on some level. And so, mm-hmm. You know, that I feel like that multiplies when it's like, oh, you know, like my chair and I had a great relationship, and I know you meet regularly with her, like you're friends mm-hmm. with her. And she was like, oh, you know, it wasn't just a, you know, just because Claire, you know, is connected in this area and knows this area, you should, you know, and we did, you know, we did kind of do that. I wrote my dissertation with the intention of making it a book. And so mm-hmm. you know, she was like, this is a great connection for you. But I think, you know, you were friends and she and I got along well. So, I mean, you know, you meet other kindred yep. kind of spirits in yeah. that way. So like yeah. we had a great connection. You have a great connection. So, you know, that just multiplies. I think there's just more of a chance that that happens when yeah. you have good connections. And then obviously if you're connecting with this person and, you know, you're probably going to connect well with the people that they connect well with. Yeah. And so, you know, that then organically does grow from there. And it's really neat to yeah. see, as you said.
And isn't that part of the richness of life? I mean, it's this, you know, connecting with new people and developing new relationships. And it, you know, as I said, when we first started talking, so many people think of mentoring as this formal kind of official relationship, you know, and setting up official times to meet and, you know, and all this other stuff. And actually, you know, it can, you develop a relationship like this and it can be very social, it can be very informal, and it can really be fun. And both the mentor and the mentee are enriched by it. And that's really the best kind of mentoring relationship. You know, it's something that's beneficial to everybody involved because it's enriching for everybody involved. And that makes it, of course, more enjoyable too.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
For sure. And sometimes I think of it in terms of, like you're saying, like it's a formal like set times and things. You know, mm-hmm. I think of it as like I have a number of friends who, and especially as I age, I just realize there's just not enough time. And I have a number of friends. I've realized this, I have these kinds of lots of these kinds of relationships where I may go years not talking to someone. Mm-hmm. And then I could pick up the phone and we could talk for hours like it was mm-hmm. yesterday that I saw them.
Right.
Or, you know, because it's just life and you get busy and you don't live in the same city or town or state anymore. And, you know, and I'll realize, gosh, it's probably been years, but we're literally chatting like I saw you yesterday. And I think of, you know, kindred mentors in that same way. I mean, I think it had been a while since I had connected with you, you know, probably a couple of years since I connected with you. And you came to mind when I was doing the podcast and I thought, Claire would be great. And so out of the blue, I send you an email and I was like, Claire. And it was like no time had passed. And so I think, you know, there's just those connections, mm-hmm. how important they are and picking, you know, and it doesn't have to always be this set thing, but just keeping those doors open, as you said, and that there's an openness on both sides is really special. I want to spend just a few minutes. I have a question here about, because you have such rich experience in this area. And I do feel like our listeners really do gravitate to and appreciate when we talk about publishing and, mm-hmm. and that process. So you have a great deal of experience mentoring people through academic publishing, that process. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that a bit more for us, maybe perhaps in terms of what you found to be most helpful for scholars going through that process and maybe the kinds of things, advice or perspectives or information mm-hmm. that you find that they need the most or find the most valuable?
Yeah, sure. So as you know, I edit a journal, Violence Against Women. It's an international and interdisciplinary journal. It's published now 16 times a year. Wow. I'm the founding editor and I've been doing it for 27 years. Mm-hmm. We, last year in 2020, we received over 740 manuscript submissions. Not all of them go out for peer review, but the vast majority do. I mean, some just, you know, get every manuscript gets a preliminary review and we check you know, to make sure it's a good fit for the journal, make sure it's readable, you know, that sort of thing. So we have to match the manuscripts with peer reviewers. And then I also edit three book series, one for Oxford University Press that I co-author with Jeff Edelson, one for University of California Press, and one for Cognello, which is more of a textbook publisher. So I spend a lot of my time reading manuscripts and engaged in the publication process, in addition to publishing my own work, writing to publish my own work.
You're not too busy. You're not too busy.
Well, I say that because I know both sides of the equation.
Yes, yes.
I know what it's like to get rejected, probably more than I would prefer to admit. but I also know the other side of it, and what I always tell people is, you know, when you get a review, I know how hard it is to read reviews sometimes. You sit there and you think, did this person actually read the paper? It sounds like they're talking about another paper, you know, or something like that. And sometimes people are not real constructive or helpful with their reviews. But I always tell people, you know, put it aside for a while, calm down, and then go back and look at it and glean major points from this. Because if you think, well, gee, this person just didn't get what I was saying, that may be an indication to you that you didn't explain it very well. I mean, if they didn't get it, chances are maybe somebody else isn't going to get it either. So it's not, the burden isn't on the reader to understand what you're trying to say. It's on you to get them to understand what you're trying to say. So I always tell people to really take reviews to heart and to approach them with an open mind, because in most cases, there are things in those reviews that you will certainly benefit from and that will be valuable in making your manuscript, whether it's a book manuscript or a journal manuscript, stronger. You know, it's just sometimes we are attached to our work. You know, it's a part of us. We've spent a lot of time on it. We've produced it. It's very dear to us. And then somebody's telling us what's wrong with it. And that's hard. That's hard to take. Yes. And we become defensive. So I tell people to try not to be defensive. I also tell them, though, that ultimately, you know, this piece of work is yours. You own it and your name is going on it. And a reviewer could be wrong about something or it just might not make sense. So you don't have to comply with every request for revision. But if you're not going to do something, you need to have a rationale for why you're not going to do it. You need to address that and say, well, here's why I don't think I should change this, or here's why that type of analysis won't work, or whatever, you know? And probably the most fundamental thing I tell people is do your homework before you send anything to anybody. Do your homework. What I mean by that is if you want to send a manuscript to a journal, oh my gosh, you know how many journals, there are hundreds of journals out there, right? In any one field. And some of them only publish quantitative work. Some of them only publish qualitative work. Some of them don't publish case studies. Some of them only publish experimental studies. You know, so just because you've heard that a journal is a great journal and it's highly ranked and has a great impact factor, that doesn't mean that your manuscript fits there or belongs there. So, you know, now with everything online, this is so easy to do. You don't even have to walk into the library and go to the stacks and look at these things. Just go online and peruse the various journals that you're interested in submitting to, or go to different publishers' websites and see what kind of books they publish. You know, if they don't publish, if they don't have a social work list, for example, then don't send a social work manuscript to them. You know, those are just very fundamental things. And people are probably sitting there going, well, duh, yeah, of course you would. I can't tell you how many people don't do that. They go on the reputation of, say, where their favorite faculty member publishes. They go on the reputation of the journal. It's so highly ranked. It's aspirational. I really want to publish in this journal. That's great, but you got to make sure that your manuscript is the right fit for that. And it's very easy to find that out. And if you can't find it online, you can query the editor. I get editor queries all the time. People send me an email and they'll send me the abstract of their manuscript and they'll say, do you think this fits? Do you think this would be a good fit? Should I submit it? And of course, I always say, I can't guarantee you it'll be published, but yes, it falls within the mission and scope of the journal, or no, we don't publish that kind of thing, you know, and then they don't waste more time by submitting it if we don't publish that sort of stuff. Now, again, most of the time you can find that online. And I always think, why didn't you just go online? But there are some things that they may not know. So for example, somebody will say, you know, I've only seen a couple of case studies published in the journal. And do you publish them? And the fact is that we really don't. Those have been truly exceptions. And typically they've been in special issues and that kind of thing. So it does help if you've already perused the journal and your questions were not answered to do a query to the editor. And you can always query a publisher as well. Find the editor for the type of book, the subject matter that you're publishing in, send them an email. Remember that these editors at publishing companies are super busy. They get swamped with requests and proposals, and sometimes whole manuscripts just come in out of nowhere. So it may take them a little while, but most of them are great at responding to emails. Because again, they're trying to save you time, and they're trying to save themselves time, and they're trying to save reviewers time too. So those are just, you know, like little things that I've done a whole series of videos on academic publishing for the American Sociological Association. I think I sent you the link, Dana, so people can go on and I think look at that. I'm not sure if you have to be a member or not.
Yeah, they may have to be a member. We'll have to see about that.
Yeah, I don't know, but
But that's no, that's great. And a lot of those things seem simple or like, you know, that, but, fit is huge. Fit's huge mm-hmm. for most areas of life, I feel mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. and definitely for publishing. And, you know, to that point about that, it's, you know, remembering that it's ultimately at the end of the day, it's your work with your mm-hmm. name on it. And I think as a graduate student or early academic, a young academic, you know, sometimes that you can lose that. You can lose that mm-hmm. piece of this is my work, and you don't have to take every note that comes yeah. down the pike. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I remember that being unclear for me as a graduate student sometimes, like, okay, so this is what's being asked of me by my chair. Is this like, do I have to do this? Do I not have to do mm-hmm. this? I'm not sure if I want to do this. And even when I was publishing my book, I almost had a different title because someone gave me a note, an editor of the series didn't prefer a from to title. And I thought I mm-hmm. needed to change it. And then I had this, like, someone spoke into that from me. They were like, why did you change that? And I was like, well, I thought I, you know, there, and I, yeah. And I drove my editor crazy. Cause then I was yeah. like, I don't really want to change it. I loved my title. Yeah. And so, I think about that. It's like a big lesson I learned of, like, at the end of the day, it's my work with my name, and, yep. and you need to be, and I'm the one who has to live with that. Right. And yeah, ultimately, exactly. And, but that can be a hard, thing to negotiate of, is this a suggestion or do I really have to do this? Well, sometimes sure. as a graduate student, and then also right. in the editing process of, and what, right. what are the implications if I don't, but like you said, explaining your rationale or explaining where you fall and land on that. But, so it seems simple, but I think they're really important and nuanced lessons that sometimes, are hard. They can be hard earned and hard learned.
Especially when you're new at it, right?
Yes.
I mean, anything yes. that you don't have a lot of experience with can be pretty challenging. And you're unsure of yourself because you just haven't done this before, or yeah. you haven't done it very much. And again, a mentor can really help in this
yes,
regard.
Yes.
Someone who's seasoned in publishing can really help in that regard. And I think sometimes people are afraid to ask for that kind of help because they're afraid that it will look bad for them, that they will look unprofessional, or they'll look stupid. I mean, for lack yeah. of a better word,
yeah.
you know, why shouldn't I know this? Well, no, why should mm-hmm. you know this?
Why should yeah.
you know, you've not done this before. We've all been there. So, yeah. Somebody who's done it a lot can certainly help somebody coming along and just hearing, you know what, I don't have to change everything. You know, it can be such yeah. a relief, right? It can
yeah.
just be
yeah.
such a relief. Well, no, you don't. If you have a good reason not to, just say yeah. what your reason is, right?
Well, and that's the value of a mentor, as you said. It was actually another scholar who was a reviewer of my work, whose work mm-hmm. I'd used for years, and she said to me, "Why did you change this?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh!" And it's almost like you know, like as you said, someone who had been through, you know, who had published extensively and who had been through this process, saying, you don't have to do that. It's like, oh, you don't know what you don't know sometimes.
Right.
And
exactly.
But I think that speaks to the importance of trust in a mentor mm-hmm. relationship of mm-hmm. being able to share that or ask, like, you know, what's the unspoken thing here? Like, I'm not really sure, and feeling safe right. enough in a relationship to ask that question. Because sometimes these decisions have really, you know, big, you know, impact.
Yeah.
And you know, that was like the title of my book. I was like, I hate for the rest of my life. I'm like, I don't really like that title. That would be horrible. And so I use that example and I go back to that in my mind a lot when I'm like, mm-hmm. and I'm like, nope, I'm going to hold my ground here because I have to live with this. And so, but I think that speaks to the importance of having trust, in a relationship and yeah. a safe space to be able to ask those things and be vulnerable in what you don't know.
Yeah,
and having a mentor say, well, why would you know that? Like, that makes
right.
you feel so much, but why would you know? You haven't done this before, right?
Yeah.
Just like anything
yeah.
in life, you haven't been through it. So you wouldn't know, would you? Unless someone, you know, you go through it and someone shares experience. And that mm-hmm. is the value of a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So as you mentioned, you are a gender scholar among many other things. And so with that in mind, I was wondering, based on your experiences and observations, have you noticed any gender dynamics worth noting when it comes to mentoring relationships in the academy?
That's a good question because that comes up all the time, right? I mean,
yeah.
the historically an argument has been made that, you know, women scholars don't get mentored because the academy has been dominated by men. And people mentor people who are most like them, that, you know, that they can identify with. And I know, I mean, there's empirical research that verifies that, right? My personal experience was not that at all. You know, I told you my mentor, I mean, that was way back, right? In this, the late 70s that I was an undergraduate, I got my PhD in 82. So that was a long time ago. And actually, I will say that when I was in graduate school, yes, I specialized in sociology of gender. But at that time, that specialty did not officially exist in our department. I had to petition to be able to take a comprehensive exam in that. And I had to form an interdisciplinary committee. I had a psychologist, an anthropologist, a philosopher, and a sociologist on the committee for the comprehensive exam in sociology of gender. Whereas most comp committees were three people from the same department. So, I mean, you know, back then things were not so easy when it came to gender, and there was a lot of sexism, not that there isn't anymore, but I'm just saying that I ended up having a man as a mentor, and it worked very well. I never felt lesser. I never felt unwelcome. I never felt that he gave male mentees more attention or more help or more offers than he did me. I never felt threatened in terms of sexual harassment or anything like that. I always felt very safe, and I was able to talk to him very easily. That's not always the case. And I do know that there are male senior faculty who have abused their positions of authority, particularly with female mentees. So I guess it's, you know, I think it matters. I think gender matters. And I also think race matters. You know, yeah. I mean, we're talking about gender, but think of all the young graduate students of color, all the young faculty of color who don't see anyone like themselves in the academy. You know, a young Black female scholar in a department with all white males, or even white males and maybe a couple of male senior scholars of color, they don't see themselves. And I think that they may be able to develop a good mentoring relationship with one of those people not like them. But the fact is, it's going to be harder in the sense that there's going to be that divide. And I think the onus is on the faculty, the senior faculty, the potential mentors, to make it clear that they can be good mentors. You know, you're never going to share that individual's positionality. You can't, you know, but that doesn't mean you can't be a good mentor to them and a very positive mentor for them. So, you know, I hope I'm not dancing around this too much, but I think it's really important for us to, particularly people who are more senior in the academy, to think about and not to overlook these differences. The differences matter, and they particularly matter for the people who, for the mentees. And so the onus is on us. And I think that, yes, we can be good mentors. We can also connect them with other people we know in our networks that can provide mentoring that we can't provide because of our positionality. Because again, the mentoring is not just one-on-one. As we said before, it's building networks. So you're not going to just have one mentor in your career or in your undergraduate or graduate training. You're going to have multiple mentors. So a good mentor will connect, as we said, the mentee with lots of people. So I think gender matters, and I think race matters, and I think gender identity and gender and sexual identity matter. All of all of those identity variables, for lack of a better term, make a big difference. They help us construct the relationships we construct. They're very much a part of who we are and who we interact with. But I don't think they have to shut down the possibility of mentoring relationships with people unlike us. And also, we need to build beyond just that one-on-one relationship. So yeah, I think it does matter. But I also think we can build from it. The mentor has to be cognizant of the difficulties the mentee will have. I see too many people who just say, well, you know, gender doesn't matter. Color doesn't matter. You know, race, ethnicity doesn't matter. Immigration status doesn't matter. We're all colleagues. Baloney. You know? Yeah. I caught myself.
That's okay. We're all big kids here, I think.
It does. All those things matter. Yeah. All those things matter, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, and I will be sure to put a link in the resources to this episode of the interview I did on mapping your mentor network. And that was a great conversation, because that's the whole gamut too, is that you don't just have one mentor. Yeah. In the course of your career, or even at any one moment, you should have multiple people that you can call upon, because not one person is going to fulfill all of those, you know, all that you need in all the different mm-hmm. areas for your career, and even at one time. And people are going to have different strengths, and so you can play to those. But I think the piece that you mentioned about just being able to connect, you know, doesn't mean you can't be a good mentor, but I think, you know, being aware of the, you know, the person in the more senior, powerful position, being aware of the importance of them acknowledging and recognizing those dynamics and where they fall short, and the onus and responsibility for how to, you know, improve and change and make connections and open doors to other relationships and, you know, and fill those gaps that are there, and acknowledging those gaps, because, you know, we're not all going to find people who, you know, check every positionality, quote unquote box, right? I hate to use that word, but in essence, I think mothering is another parenting, mm-hmm. and mothering especially is another huge piece that people really need and desire, you know, mentoring around. That can be a very difficult thing to navigate in the mm-hmm. academy, mm-hmm. and all the unspoken gender dynamics and stereotypes that come with that. And I remember going through that when I was a graduate student too, mm-hmm. of like, oh, you know, what are people, you know, you don't know what people are really thinking, and you know what they think, this is how this is going to affect your work, and you know, all that sort of stuff. And so I think there's so many different pieces to who we are as people. We're very, you know, it's a very complex, and so is mentoring, because it's a human endeavor, and it's a human relationship. And
these positionality, all this stuff intersects, all these identity variables intersect. So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, you know, we're going to focus on race, or we're going to focus on gender, or we're going to focus on sexual identity. They all intersect. Mm-hmm. You know, that Patricia Hill Collins's concept mm-hmm. of the matrix of domination, it really matters. It really, really matters. They're not linear, you know?
Yes.
And it's really hard to deal with that, but it's worth dealing with. It's a must if we're going to have productive mentoring relationships. I think sometimes people who want to mentor just think it's, you know, you just do it, and you don't need to think about these things. You give advice. But I think you have to really be aware of your own positionality as a mentor, you know, mm-hmm. not think in terms of the mentee as much as what power do you have? Yeah. What are you doing with this power? What are you doing with this position that you have, this authority? How is this affecting different people who are coming to you? And I think that lots of times senior faculty mentors don't think about that, mm-hmm. you know, or some don't want to think about it, but I don't think you can have a good relationship, a productive and healthy relationship really with anybody. Unless you think about those things, because there are power dynamics in every every relationship, every situation, and particularly in the academy. We like to think that, you know, we're all equal, but in the academy, there's so much of that going on.
Yeah, there's definitely a hierarchy. And, and if you're on the bottom end of that, you are very well aware of it.
You are.
You're very well aware of it.
You can't afford to ignore it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it helps a whole lot when the folks at the top of that hierarchy are aware of that and are helping and using their positionality and their power in ways to shift dynamics for the better. Yep. And to open doors and opportunities and make connections and all of those things. And you know, back to your point about how it all intersects, the thing to remember too is no matter, you know, what that positionality is, it intersects and looks differently for every person. And that's the reality too. Context matters. It matters the context of where the advice is coming from and the context of where the advice is being directed. Like it's every, you know, what can you tell what I'm qualitative? Everything's contextual, right? Everything's contextual and that context matters. And positionality matters and power matters. And being aware of that is really the first step to making it a healthy, safe space. Because, you know, that's what people are doing in these relationships. You're trying to figure out what can I say? What can I not say? What can I ask? What can I not ask? What can I share? Mm-hmm. And because you don't know how it's going to be perceived until, you know, until you realize, okay, I think this is a safe space. I can share these things. And so about my positionality, about where I'm coming from, or about my questions, about all of that. And so to have, you know, I agree with you, to have the most productive, healthy, useful relationship is to be aware of that, to create that safe space so that it benefits not just that individual person, that mentee, but the academy as a whole.
Yes.
Right. To move in a better place, to move us all to a better place in the academy. Oh, Claire, I have so many more questions I would love to ask you, but we are at time. So thank you so much. I will ask if you care to maybe share just before we close what you're working on now, if you want to share that with listeners.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So one of the projects that I'm working on that I just absolutely love and want to always tell everybody about is I'm working with Diane Follingstead, who is a clinical and forensic psychologist. She and I are co-PIs on a federally funded research project that's evaluating the therapeutic horticulture program at the local battered women's shelter in Lexington. Our shelter in Lexington is called Greenhouse 17. They changed their name a few years ago from the Bluegrass Domestic Violence Program. And the name reflects the fact that the shelter is located on farmland. It's actually right adjacent to a horse farm, and the horses come over to the fence and stuff, which the kids there absolutely love. But what started out as a pretty small farm has grown into quite an enterprise, and they have a space now where they can make soaps and lotions and lip balms and things like that. They do flower and vegetable CSAs. They grow food for the shelter, and they have now a chef in the kitchen who talks about nutrition and prepares food right from the garden, right from the farm. They have lots of different crops. There's a farm manager. But our project evaluates the residents' participation in the farming, in the horticulture, actually going out and, you know, planting, weeding, harvesting, etc., all the chores that have to be done in farming. Because there's a whole body of literature on how interacting with nature and engaging in these types of activities are restorative, particularly for people who have experienced trauma. But it's never been tested before with women who have experienced intimate partner violence. And it was started at this shelter, and we got very excited about it. They were telling us anecdotal evidence about women who were having really good outcomes after participating in the farm, but they didn't have any systematic empirical data. They only had some good stories. And of course, you know, if you want to keep getting funding for something, you need some proof that it's working. And so we developed a really great partnership with the staff at the shelter, and we applied for this grant from the Office on Violence Against Women and got it. And we're in our, let's see, our fifth year. 1 year was paused. It doesn't count because of COVID. We're in our fifth year. This is really our last year. But what happens is women can elect to work on the farm, and they get paid for the work that they do, and they can work for up to 6 weeks. And then we have basically what we call the control group, the women who don't want to work on the farm, but they engage in standard shelter programming. And we do measures, various measures, measures of self-esteem, self-efficacy, I mean, you know, stuff like that, at baseline, and then at various points during the shelter stay. And then we do a post-shelter interview. And we're going to compare the outcomes for the women who participate in the therapeutic horticulture program with those who participate in just standard shelter programming. I will give you a little hint or a little preview. The preliminary findings that we've looked at so far indicate that both groups of women show improvement from baseline, from when they enter the shelter, in all sorts of areas. They get better. But the women who are doing the horticulture program are getting even better than that. So their scores are even higher. So just being at the shelter and engaging in standard programming is beneficial to the women. It helps them in all sorts of areas. But those who are participating in the farm program, so far it looks like they're having better outcomes in certain areas. So stay tuned. We'll be publishing a lot of results from this study in the next couple of years.
It sounds like an amazing project. And I am familiar with that organization. I did some volunteering with them when I lived in Lexington. So it's wonderful to hear how it's grown and you know, the programs that you're doing in this study sounds pretty fabulous. So thank
you
so much.
It's a wonderful place. It's a great place. I'm really fortunate to be associated with them. And the staff there is fabulous. Really, really great.
Yes.
And the women are amazing in terms of their resilience. I'm in awe of the women who are there. They're just amazing women and children.
Yes. Yes. It was a wonderful program when I was a part of it years ago, and it sounds like it's grown just exponentially and you're doing so much great stuff there. So that will be exciting to hear about and to share about. And maybe we'll have you back on to talk about, you know, some of that stuff. I have so many topics I could have you talk about, Claire. And we touched on just a few of them today, but thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing your experiences and expertise on mentoring in particular in the Academy. So thank you.
It was really my pleasure, Dana. Thank you for having me.
I'm Dr. Dana Malone. This is The Academic Life, and you've been listening to New Books Network. Please join us again.